This is the Cullinane and Green Report. Our special guest today is Vinton G. Cerf.
Welcome to the Cullinane and Green Report. I'm Joe Cullinane.
And I'm Roger Green.
We're privileged to have as our guest on the Cullinane and Green Report, Vint Cerf. Vint Cerf is President and Chief Internet Evangelist for Google. He's responsible for identifying new enabling technologies and applications on the Internet and other platforms for the company. Widely known as a father of the Internet, Vint is the co-designer with Robert Kahn of the TCP/IP protocols and basic architecture of the Internet. In 1997, President Clinton recognized their work with the U.S. National Medal of Technology. In 2005, Vint and Bob received the highest civilian honor bestowed in the U.S., the Presidential Medal of Freedom. It recognizes the fact that their work on the software code used to transmit data across the Internet has put them, quote, at the forefront of a digital revolution that has transformed global commerce, communication, and entertainment. From 1994 to 2005, Vint served as Senior Vice President at MCI. Prior to that, he was Vice President of the Corporation for National Research Initiatives, and from 1982 to 86, he served as Vice President of MCI. During his tenure with the U.S. Department of Defense's Advanced Research Projects Agency, known as DARPA, from 1976 to 1982, Vint played a key role leading the development of Internet and Internet-related data packet and security technologies. Since 2000, Vint has served as chairman of the board of the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, otherwise known as ICANN, and he has been a visiting scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory since 1998. He served as a founding president of the Internet Society from 1992 to 1995 and was on the ISOC board until 2000. Vint is a fellow of the IEEE, ACM, AAAS, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the International Engineering Consortium, the Computer History Museum, and the National Academy of Engineering. Vint has received numerous awards and commendations in connection with his work on the Internet, including the Marconi Fellowship, Charles Stark Draper Award of the National Academy of Engineering, President of Asturias Award for Science and Technology, the Alexander Graham Bell Award presented by the Alexander Graham Bell Association for the Deaf, the AM Turing Award from the Association for Computing Machinery, the Silver Medal of the International Telecommunications Union, and the IEEE Alexander Graham Bell Medal, among many others. He holds a PhD in computer science from UCLA and more than a dozen honorary degrees. We're delighted to welcome Vint Cerf to the Cullinane and Green Report today.
Hi, it's Vint and Joe and Roger. It's a pleasure to be on the call with you.
Vint, I have a question that I've been dying to ask you for a long time. When you were first architecting the Internet, and particularly TCP/IP, did you have any inkling that the Internet would develop into this world-changing technology that it's become?
Well, no, to be honest with you. The short answer is no. It's also important to remember that Bob Kahn started this project and asked me to join him. He was very interested in the possibility of open architecture networking and very interested in the use of computers in command and control. Remember that this project was started as a Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency initiative after the ARPANET had demonstrated so successfully that packet switching is doing well. It turned out that that we were pretty sure that we had an important technology that we were trying, or problem that we were trying to solve, and we thought that if we did solve it, it would be useful to the Defense Department. We also knew that when we were working on it, we were doing it with the civilian research community in the research universities that were supported by DARPA's Information Processing Techniques Office. So all of those things suggested to us, or at least suggested to me, that if we were successful in solving this problem of interconnecting multiple packet switch networks, that we would have a very useful technology. But I don't think either of us had any sense that this was going to become a global system used for a variety of purposes that many people never might have anticipated.
Well, it certainly speaks to the sophistication of your design that it was able to scale to that, and I think it says a lot for creating good specs at the outset of a project.
Vint, you've been at the forefront of technology for many years now, from creating the building blocks to the internet to your current position at Google. Tell us a little bit about what you're working on these days at Google.
Well, it's probably more accurate to say that there are 8,000 people at Google working on about 9,000 different things. there are about half of the complement of Google employees are engineers, and I can assure you that they are working on quite a wide range of applications. In fact, the way we organize the company, or I should say the way Larry and Eric and Sergey organize the company, the engineers are free to explore ideas pretty much on their own for about 10% of their time, which they do anyway, so we just build that into the management structure.
Right.
70% of their time is spent on assigned projects that have been approved and budgeted and have a business model behind them. And 20% of their time is used typically to work on projects that have been approved, but that they might not be assigned to work on them. But if the other people that are assigned to work on them are willing to invite additional help, then they're free to participate. And so this 70-20-10 rule has led to some pretty startling new developments, some of which were not anticipated as part of the ordinary planned development effort. So Keyhole, for example, which became Google Earth, was one of those 10 or 20% projects which right. blossomed into a very interesting effort. So I think to summarize an answer to your question, though, if you recall the basic motto of the company, which is to organize the world's information and make it accessible, we really are trying to do that in a wide range of different media. So although we started with the World Wide Web and a text-based searching capability, we've expanded this to include the desktop, to include the enterprise, which require different techniques than searching the web, since we don't have the same hyperlinking going on typically in someone's desktop or in a company archive. So we have to use different techniques for doing the indexing and the ordering of responses. We're very interested in media other than simple text, so we're looking at video and audio and other kinds of imagery, photographs and the like. How can we help people organize that kind of information? We're also quite interested in applications that involve personal information, so allowing people to upload videos to be made available in Google Video is an example, scanning of books and then making them indexable and therefore searchable is another area of great interest to us, and we're hoping that some of the world's great libraries with material which is probably never formally copyrighted but which would be very valuable to discover in an online environment is also part of our objective. So you'll find Google working very hard in quite a wide range of applications in order to help people find and manage information and to collaborate. So you'll see things like Google's Writely and its shared spreadsheet programs in attempting to help people share their information more effectively. And that's just the beginning.
Just as an interesting side note, Vint, we actually use Writely extensively for all of our collaboration, Joe and I, and all of the interview questions and everything that we develop for the show is done in Writely. We've been a user for some time, and we really believe in it. Wouldn't you say, Joe, it's one of the really enabling technologies for us?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great tool. In fact, we worked on the questions for this interview using Writely. I have a follow-on question. It says here that your current role is Chief Internet Evangelist. So specifically, what do they have you doing as Chief Internet Evangelist?
Well, that's a good question. It turns out that when I first asked Eric if he wanted some help with the company, and he sent back quickly a note saying yes, then they said, what title do you want? And so I, nonchalantly suggested Archduke.
that's good. Always go for the royalty,
right? Why not? So they decided that probably didn't fit in very well with the rest of their nomenclature, and came back with the Chief Internet Evangelist. And truth to tell, that's not a bad characterization of what I've spent the last 35 years doing, which is trying to get people to build more internet and to deploy it everywhere in the world. that would certainly be very good for Google's business model, because the more people that are on the net, the more probability there is that they'll come across some of our ads and some people will click on them. So the job is fashioned around several themes. One of them is indeed going around talking about internet and trying to help especially developing worlds become more online. Second, I spend time at all of the Google engineering offices around the world now, of which there are probably almost a score. So to visit those takes up a fair chunk of my time because many of them are quite far away. In that capacity, I'm acting more like an intellectual bumblebee trying to uncover either technology or techniques or problems that particular engineering groups are working on with the intent of highlighting other groups' interests in similar problems or maybe solutions in those problems. I spent time with that. I spent time at universities helping the company recruit engineers, although to be honest with you, we get quite an avalanche of resumes coming from students who are just graduating and many people who are simply very interested in Google. I spend some of my time talking to companies about their products and services that might be of interest to Google. I do a fair amount of public relations interaction. This is an example of that. But I also spend time in the, let's say, in the policy branch dealing with legislative matters or other legal matters. So I'm in the U.S. spending time with the Congress and the Senate on such issues as net neutrality and have spent time on that subject and many others with other governments around the world in the UK, in New Zealand, in Brazil, and so on. So a part of my task is to help with the policy development and policy articulation in areas of interest to Google. And in my copious spare time, Google permits me to continue my work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory on an interplanetary extension of the Internet, which is going quite well. And, of course, I continue to serve as chairman of the board of ICANN, which also consumes a notable part of my time.
So, Vint, I was going to ask you about some of the new frontiers for the Internet, and you threw out the interplanetary aspect, and I have to confess, I hadn't really thought about that too much. Are you getting a big demand for that? Are there people on other planets who want to sign on?
Let me tell you, the Martians are chomping at the bit. I sometimes chide my colleagues at ICANN on the board that our policies are overly Earth-centric and that we need to get a better perspective. Actually,
that's certainly true.
The work that's going on interplanetary expansion has to do with supporting space exploration using networking techniques that are similar in capability to the Internet. They have to be a little different because, technically speaking, the round-trip times are so long, it could be minutes to hours, that some of the protocols that make up the terrestrial Internet don't work very well. In any case, it's intended to be supportive of space exploration.
That's very interesting. Along with that must come some interesting policy questions.
Well, let me separate terrestrial policy from interplanetary policy.
Okay.
On the interplanetary side, I mean, we're having trouble trying to recognize alien porn, for instance, so we don't know what to block. because we actually can't tell, you know, is that normal or what's going on?
I could see where you'd get a lot of volunteers working on that.
Though, absolutely, yes. Coming back to Earth momentarily, there are a number of policy issues that arise for Google and for ICANN and for all of us internauts. Intellectual property protection is an issue. Sometimes the domain name system gets wrapped up in this because of the WHOIS database that's associated with it.
Right.
Law enforcement and intellectual property protection authorities are eager to have substantial, accurate information available to the public in order to make their job of enforcement easier. And the public, in some sections anyway, is saying, well, we prefer not to have that personal information easily available to the public. They're concerned about privacy and maybe even identity theft. So there's a great tension there, which probably will be resolved by recognizing that the data has to be accurate, but not necessarily everyone should have the authority to look at it.
Sure.
So that's one area. Another one has to do in general with the kinds of abuse that you see taking place on the Internet, whether that's denial of service attacks and more recently the reflective denial of service attacks that actually use the DNS system as a tool against the target, Trojan horses, fishing and farming and all these other kinds of things, spam, are all difficulties which are in large measure not addressable through ICANN, but might need to be addressed in possibly multilateral international settings.
Right.
A consequence of a four-year program called the World Summit on the Information Society has led to a considerable global debate about the internet and what internet governance might mean and who should do it. And I can guarantee you that the topic is filled with a great deal of debate with differing opinions. Personally, I think that internet governance is an extremely broad subject because it includes such matters as fraud and abuse. It includes the question of authentication of parties using the network in order to facilitate commerce, for example. But it also encompasses abusive behavior, hijacking of various kinds, the use of expired domain names for purposes of either putting up advertisements or possibly even using it to draw attention to material that children shouldn't see, for example.
Sure. Sure.
These are all issues that cannot be addressed in large measure by ICANN, but should be addressed at governmental levels and probably in a cooperative way. So there is now an Internet Governance Forum, which will have its first meeting in October in Athens. I and a number of my colleagues will be in attendance at that meeting, hoping to steer the conversation towards areas where ICANN has no jurisdiction or no mechanism for responding to a problem, but which problem does need to be addressed. So I hope coming out of this Internet Governance Forum will be some productive recommendations for steps that could be taken in order to alleviate some of the abuse on the net.
Good luck. Be strong.
Yeah, thank you.
You mentioned net neutrality. Could you like to elaborate a little bit on that? I know that there's quite a bit of discussion and a little controversy about that issue.
There's actually a great deal of controversy, and to borrow a term from Bob Pepper, who for many years served at the FCC, it has reached the stage where many people are simply flinging bumper stickers at each other without even being willing to sit down and talk about what the real problems are. So let me try to outline this situation and where would a term like net neutrality have arisen. The local exchange carriers in the U.S. and the cable companies are both responsible for providing broadband service to users. Here, I think we're focused primarily on the residential user. So whether you're using a cable modem or a digital subscriber loop, you're theoretically getting access to a broadband connection to the internet. What has happened in the last, let's say, 6 to 9 months is that at least one of the local exchange carriers, the new AT&T, former SBC, has said rather loudly that their business model requires that other parties besides the residents pay for access to the broadband network. And so they're saying, well, it's costing us a lot of money. We should have the right to do anything we want to with the capacity that we're putting in. And what we decide we are going to do is to charge application service providers, content providers, for the privilege of allowing their traffic to flow to the subscribers to the broadband service over the broadband access points. So in effect, they're saying to the application service providers of the world, we think you're getting a free ride on our access network, and therefore you should pay us for the privilege of passing your traffic over it, sort of like turning the internet into a toll road. We were quite concerned at Google about this, not so much because Google couldn't afford to pay, but rather that it would stifle innovation in the internet. And this is not something that we would want to do lightly. The internet, despite the dot boom and the dot bust, has been a remarkably fertile environment in which new ideas can be pursued. The guys that started Google, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, did not have to get permission from a telephone company in order to try out their idea. Similarly, Skype didn't have to get permission to try out their idea, and as you noted earlier, we're actually using Skype for this communication.
That's right.
So the innovation in the internet has been invited by the fact that it's openly accessible and that any user getting access to the net has the freedom to go to any service provider on the internet. This change in position with regard to the broadband services would be very harmful, in my view, to stimulating new applications. If you're a new company and you couldn't afford to pay for broadband transit, your product, no matter how good it is, might never get started because you couldn't even afford to have connectivity at the other end. I mean, everyone, including Google, who provides internet service, ends up paying for access to the net. Either you pay directly to another service provider, or you might have a peering arrangement, in which case you have to pay for all the capacity that connects your network to any of the peering points that are used to interface you to the public network. So there is an absolute economic cost to anyone offering internet services online, and it's wrong to say that those parties are getting a free ride. So I'm very concerned about the side effects of the proposals that the RBOX and the broadband carriers are making. I'm also rather disturbed that, they seem to be focused on reproducing cable television, in effect.
Right.
The way I interpret what they're saying is, well, we need to have special access to our broadband facilities in order to make sure streaming video works. It requires high priority, et cetera, et cetera. And I have two problems with this. One of them is that it would look to me as if they're trying to literally recreate what the cable network does. And in the course of doing that, they'll simply try to fight for some market share from the existing incumbents, the cable companies and the satellite broadcast companies. When you fight for market share, you don't necessarily increase the total size of the market. And so it seems to me that they may actually be eroding that market to some degree by competing with the television companies, cable companies rather, and the satellite carriers. So they seem to be determined to invent a kind of 500 channel television out of internet, and I am alarmed at that, because I think that if they turned around and opened this up, as is done in the UK and in the Netherlands, in New Zealand and the like, then more applications could be invented which would draw more users into the internet's ambit, and would probably give them at least as good, if not better, possibility of revenue enhancement just because of the creativity that it permits. So our network neutrality concerns are largely surrounding fair access by the consumer to virtually any site in the destination internet. We have been proponents of legislation that would make it illegal to discriminate unfairly among various sources of internet traffic, particularly the service sources. There are arguments against it on the grounds that improperly or poorly written legislation would be worse than no legislation at all. We do understand the risk there, but I think we generally believe, as do many of our colleagues, that it's better to have in writing a statement that certain behaviors will be treated as illegal or improper and will be prosecuted, rather than leaving it open to have to try to detect what you think is abuse and then argue that it is, without being able to point to any particular legal framework which interprets the misbehavior as an abuse. So we're still very much in favor of legislation that would allow for a kind of framework in which to judge proper use of the net by the broadband carrier.
It seems like, judging from comments from certain elected officials, that there is a wealth of ignorance at the legislative level as to what the internet actually is and how it works and what it might do.
That is a persistent problem with all legislatures, I think. And the problem is that although I spent perhaps 20-plus years on occasion briefing members of the Congress and the staff, members come and go, the staff come and go, the internet continues to evolve, and the consequence of that is that it's been hard to help the legislators have at least a cartoon model in their heads about how the internet works, so that they can reason properly from this simplified model and come to the right kinds of conclusions. So we're still working on that problem.
The internet is one of these rare innovations that is actually appears to be living up to a lot of the hype at the beginning as to what it could do in terms of displacing old technologies and connecting people all over the world. And that creates a bit of a burden. We certainly see the internet having a role in this new notion of globalization, or as Tom Friedman called it, the flattening of the earth, really. And when we had Tim Draper on, he talked a lot about citizens in countries like China who have access to the internet and are able to use it to communicate with other citizens around the world from other countries. How do you see this role of globalization changing for the internet? And do you see it as all positive, or is there a dark side to it as well?
Well, on the whole, I see it as a very positive change, because the opportunity to get access to information that might otherwise have been inaccessible, I think, is terribly powerful. Even in China, where the government has concerns about information that it considers to be politically dangerous, you still can see enormous benefits to the citizens of China because of their ability to discover information and to get access to it readily.
Right.
So the dark side, of course, of all this is that some governments really do intervene and want to censor what's available to the citizens. This is sometimes in what I would say good faith, that is to say, a sincere belief that some information is disruptive and shouldn't be permitted, child pornography being an example.
Right.
And with which most people would agree. In the case of Google, for example, we struggled for over a year before we concluded that we should, in fact, operate in China, despite the fact that we've had to deliberately and voluntarily limit access to certain kinds of information. We do this based on guidelines that are provided, and we also have the permission of the government to show when something has been withheld. We actually put a little note up on the screen saying that this information was withheld because of the governmental restrictions.
That's
so at least we're able to alert our Chinese users when something has been removed. So it's not a silent process. And of course, it's important to note that Google.cn is the system which has the filters. Google.com does not. And so if it should happen that a Chinese citizen has access to the public internet by one means or another, he or she will still be able to get to the full content that Google is able to provide. So I think there is a dark side to all of this, but it's vastly overshadowed, in my view, by all the positive things that one can do with this kind of networking technology. The sharing of information in the scientific domain, the sharing of medical information, the sharing of cultural information, the sharing of factual information, books and things like that, are all very important. Plainly, intellectual property protection becomes a critical issue in this area. So I'm still very positive on the side of the good part of internet, believing that only a small portion of it is being abused and by any definition of abuse.
Vint, as you know, the Cullinane and Green Report focuses on how emerging technologies relate to business development. Certainly Google has done an amazing job in monetizing search and advertising. Do you see other business applications emerging that are not so obvious to everyone else? What's coming along that's exciting you?
Well, first of all, I should tell you that as a matter of policy, Google does not announce any products or services that it's not ready to announce or doesn't talk about them. So there may be things that Google is doing that probably are not yet ripe for public discussion. But I would say several things. First of all, you and your listeners have no doubt noticed that there are on the order of 2.5 billion mobile telephones in use today.
Sure.
And these telephones are more than telephones. They're being used for a variety of applications, including short messaging and email and surfing the net. So they're really information appliances, and this means that some people will use them to get information on the net. In some cases, the fact that these devices are able to detect global positioning satellite information means that this same device could use that information in the course of developing a query in order to formulate the question and get an answer. So if you were walking down the street and you said, "Where's the nearest ATM machine?" that's not a well-formed question unless the party you're asking that question of also knows where you are when you ask that question. So increasingly, we're finding these mobile programmable devices are becoming handhelds that perform quite a wide range of functions, including location. So in the long term, I'm expecting location-oriented data to have a very high monetary value, and so you'll probably see more and more applications that make use of it.
Vint, I'd like to ask you a question that's coming from a different angle. I know you get asked probably similar questions over and over again in these interviews, and we'd like to give you the chance on our show to ask you what questions you don't get asked that you wish you did, that you'd have the chance to answer. Yeah, we're going to give you that opportunity today.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
No problem.
I guess people sometimes have a funny model of where the internet came from, and they imagine that it just got invented in whole cloth, and they don't fully appreciate how much work was involved in making it happen and how many people have contributed to it. So if I were being asked, or if I were proposing questions, one of them would be to say a little more about all the other people who have had so much to do with the internet and continue to have a lot to do with it today.
Please do.
Well, people like Bob Kahn, but then there are the predecessors to the project, the Larry Roberts and the Bob Taylors of the world, J.C.R. Licklider, who started the Information Processing Techniques Office at ARPA, and who wrote in a tongue-in-cheek memo that he wanted to talk to his colleagues about an intergalactic network. In fact, in the course of developing the interplanetary extension to the Internet, we needed a new very long-haul protocol, which we now christened the Licklider Transport Protocol in recognition of J.C.R. Licklider's contribution to thinking.
That's very interesting.
Along networking lines. Other people like David Clark and John Postel, both of whom have played major roles in the history of the Internet. John, of course, passing away in 1998 after serving as the editor of the Request for Comment series and the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority for at least 25 years. Dave Clark was the chairman of the Internet Architecture Board for many years and continues to contribute to networking technology. Steve Crocker, who in fact blazed a trail for the predecessor to TCP/IP on the ARPANET called NZP, and who started the Request for Comment series of documentation, which is now up to something like, document number 3700. I won't go on and on, but there are many, many people who can take some credit for the development of the Internet. I, for one, wish that there were a way to recognize them more fully than even in this short kind of interview.
I have one last question for you. Obviously, we think a lot of podcasting. I was just wondering what your view of podcasting as a communication and business tool, what your view is. And do you listen to podcasts?
Okay, the first answer is that podcast is extremely important. I consider it to be a harbinger of things to come. I think that video and audio on demand no longer mean streaming audio and video, which is what the local exchange carriers often mean when they're talking about these sorts of things, because they're stuck in this rebuild the cable network idea. I see podcasting and downloading of audio and video as a way in which users will get more control over what they see and when they see it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're already seeing users happy to take control over the advertising aspects of the Internet, where they look for things as opposed to being forced to look at things. So that's a very powerful tool. I think that mobility, the use of Internet with mobile devices, will become much, much more important as more and more of these devices are available and as they become GPS-enabled. I think that more household and office appliances will be online. I think that many, many more scientific instruments will be online. I'm anticipating, therefore, that we will see an increasing amount of tailoring of network services to individuals. Fortunately, I think that's going to be made easier to do by the ability to download various forms of Java code in order to personalize a particular service to a customer. In our case, in the search world, one thing we would like to do is to understand our users well enough that we can tailor the answers that we give them to what we believe their interests to be. And in order to effectively implement that, we may very well need to track what this is under the user's control, track the nature of the user's queries, and then use that to build some sort of a mapping from the query that's being made by that user and the rank ordering of responses that come back. So I think this notion of relevance will be extremely important as the competition for improved search engines continues to increase.
Vint, it's been great having you as a guest on the Cullinan and Green Report, and I really want to thank you for sharing your unique perspectives with our listeners.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to participate in this call, and I'm looking forward to future ones. And in the meantime, I'll see you on the net.
Well, thank you very much, and we know that surf's up when this goes on. Thanks for listening to the Cullinan and Green Report. We hope you'll join us again next time. In the meantime, remember, we're on the bleeding edge, so you don't have to be.